by the Justice Department as a box or container from storage room included 8 press clippings from 2017 to 2020, 3 documents marked top secret, an article of clothing, a book, and 1,841 government documents or photographs without classification markings. The chaotic and wide-ranging contents of the boxes reflected previous reporting by The Guardian and others that the West Wing and the White House residence was packed up in a hurry and in haphazard fashion during the final days and final hours of Donald Trump's presidency. According to former aides, Donald Trump was something of a pack rat who hoarded materials he saw as his, and partly as a consequence of his refusal to accept that he'd lost the 2020 election. Many items from the White House were collected into boxes that were transported to his residence at Mar-a-Lago. The Justice Department said the items listed in the inventory have already been screened for potential attorney-client privilege. Judge Eileen Cannon is expected to rule shortly on whether to grant Donald Trump's request to have a special master conduct a filter instead. At least 320 classified documents have been recovered from Mar-a-Lago since January. More than 100 of those were seized in the August search. The Justice Department has also released a photograph of folders marked secret and top secret scattered over a Mar-a-Lago carpet. Some were stamped "No Fawn," indicating they should not be seen by any non-US citizen without permission. Donald Trump has decried the investigation as a politically motivated attack on him, and nearly all top Republicans have closed ranks around him and rallied to his defense. His lawyers have sought to argue that the case should be treated akin to failing to return a late library book, not a real threat or conspiracy. Donald Trump has never explained his motive in retaining these documents, and top Democrats have said his resistance to returning them to the Justice Department, even after being subpoenaed, is evidence of obstruction of justice that the Justice Department should prosecute. The U.S. Democrats have also said the documents reveal a fundamental lawlessness in Donald Trump's behavior, characterized by acting with impunity and a disregard for the U.S. norms and traditions that usually govern former presidents. At the same time, the scandal has probably harmed Donald Trump's frequent hints that he wants to run for the White House again in 2024. Joe Biden has used the FBI search as part of a general warning of the extremist nature of Donald Trump and his followers, which in a primetime speech on Thursday night, 1st of September, he portrayed as a growing threat to American democracy and a potential cause of political violence. Since the FBI raid of Mar-a-Lago, numerous law enforcement officials have warned that federal buildings and government workers are at risk of attack, especially as right-wing politicians and media pundits have sought to blame them for seeking to stop any Trump political comeback.
U.S. and the Soviet Union.
Part 1.
On June 8, 1967, news spreads around the world which wasn't easy to believe. Unknown attackers target a U.S. military ship in the Mediterranean Sea. After World War II, this was the first time someone had dared to attack the U.S. military. April 30th, 1945, when an all-out rivalry broke out between the Western Allies and the USSR to conquer Berlin, soldiers of the Red Army reached the heart of Nazi Germany sooner than the Americans. With the fall of the city and Adolf Hitler committing suicide, the flames of the horrendous Second War in Europe burnt out. With all the death and destruction, as World War II was coming to an end, the two powerful conquerors could raise their flags on the mountains of soil and ashes and reorganize world order the way they wanted to. The Eastern powerhouse was the USSR, which had the dream of spreading the ideals of communism and saving the masses of the labor force from the oppression of capitalists. And on the other side, the wealthy Western powerhouse, meaning the U.S., was standing on the principles of using capital to create welfare. In the post-war modern era, both rivals tried very hard to win the competition and defeat their tenacious opponent. It was an all-out rivalry, which wasn't very friendly at all. An arms race, the strengthening of military forces and economies, and many other issues had created a battlefield between the two poles, which later became known as the Cold War. It was a time when the East and West would on the surface shake the hands of friendship, but in secret, point their weapons at each other. The Cold War and all its fearsome features took the U.S. and USSR to the brink of war on a number of occasions. But under the shadows of a scary invention, it never turned into an actual armed conflict. It was the dark clouds of nuclear fission and the devastating shadow of the atomic bomb which kept the flames of the Cold War from flaring up. The USSR was doing everything in its power to entice the masses toward communist ideals and turn governments into its allies. Of course, the USSR had to some extent succeeded, and communism was rapidly spreading around the world. Many big and small countries added the Red Star of Communism to their flag and stood with the Eastern camp. Communist ideology was rapidly spreading to weaker countries, and the formidable rival of the USSR had to do something to solve this problem. The U.S. wasn't idly sitting by either. With Truman's four-point program and Kennedy's Peace Corps, it tried to neutralize the USSR's plans.
This corps will be a pool of trained men sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. It will not be easy. None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health.
The fact is, The U.S. wanted to create structural transformation and elevate welfare levels in weaker countries to create a bloc against the propaganda of the communists. Back then, the U.S. had no bigger goal than combating communism, so it did everything it could to win the hearts of the countries in need and remind them that the country that is truly worried about global welfare is the U.S., not the Soviet Union. But the battle of the Cold War powerhouses, like any other complicated game, had hidden layers which made the battle hotter and hotter. At a time like this, the center of gravity when it comes to global politics and energy, meaning the Middle East, wasn't spared of the game of choosing sides between the East and the West. The region has always been the battleground for global powers. The USSR got to the Middle East sooner than its rival and had won over the hearts of Arab leaders. The prime minister of the USSR was an ally of Gamal Abdel Nasser, Egypt's second president. With the help of Abdel Nasser's influence among Arabs in the region, the Soviets wanted to change the color of the map of the Middle East into the red communist star. The Soviets knew that the entrance gate of the Arab world was Egypt and Abdel Nasser. By raising the ideology of pan-Arabism to unite the Arab race, and of course his constant quarrels with its unwanted neighbor, Israel, Nasser had become the hero of Arabs. When Egypt, at the forefront of the Arab world, showed communism the green light, Syria also leaned towards the USSR. Syria had recently united with Egypt and established the United Arab Republic. A short while later, in May 1967, Anwar Sadat, the Speaker of the National Assembly of Egypt, went to Moscow to meet with Soviet Prime Minister Alexei Kosygin. That's where he was told that America's friend, meaning Israel, had gathered a large number of its forces on the Syrian border and the threat of an Israeli attack on the United Arab Republic was serious. The communists were forced to give this mischievous news to Egypt because they thought that military confrontation between the allies of the East and the West in the Middle East would lead to the victory of the Eastern Bloc.
We believed a war could bring us political gains. Even a stalemate could bring us benefits. Egypt had our backing, both political and military. We thought their forces would demonstrate the benefits of Soviet support. So we were confident that the balance of power in the Middle East would be altered by a localized war.
When Gamal Abdel Nasser received word that Israeli forces had amassed on the Syrian border, he wasted no time. He immediately wrote to the UN and asked the organization to withdraw its peacekeeping forces, which had been stationed on the border of the neighboring countries from the previous war between Egypt and Israel. Nasser wanted to fill up the entire border Egypt had with this unwanted neighbor with his own military forces. It seemed the Soviets' plot for a war between the ideologies of the East and the West in the Middle East had really worked. Nasser took a further step, that putting his forces on standby and shut down the strategic straits of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba. The Straits of Tiran were the only waterway access Israel had with the eastern part of the world. The only passageway for the Israelis to import fuel had been shut down to the Zionists, and with this, war became inevitable.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
The The USSR wanted to prove its friendship to Egypt and, of course, not be left behind from its rival, the US, in equipping its allies in the intelligence field. So, it got to work and laid cables on the seabed from the USSR to Egypt. The purpose was to be able to whisper in the ears of the Egyptians anytime it wanted. When the USSR realized that it's too late and the war will inevitably happen sooner or later, it ordered its naval forces in the Black Sea to move closer to Egypt's shores. Based on this order, 20 Soviet warships sailed to the east of the Mediterranean and were put on standby position. The USSR didn't want to leave its Arab allies alone in the war against Israel. But on the other front, the US ordered its 6th Fleet based in the Mediterranean to pull back from at least 100 miles from the danger zone. But one of the ships in the 6th Fleet didn't receive the order. As the entire fleet was pulling back, the USS Liberty had received orders to get closer to the Sinai shores. The Liberty was an unarmed naval ship with 45 powerful eavesdropping antennas, tens of advanced data processing and information analysis devices with language experts and professional analysts who were used to listen in on radio communications. The Liberty was getting closer to the crisis region to listen in on what was happening.
If it was broadcast on a radio wave, we could receive it at any frequency, low frequency, high frequency, medium frequency, very low frequency. If it was out there, we could receive it. If we were listening and we heard a signal and when we looked at it, we couldn't understand it, it was encrypted as well. We'd send it back to NSA and let them hit it with their computers.
The Liberty's confidential messages were radioed to the NSA, the U.S.'s top secret intelligence agency for the analysis and data processing of electric intelligence. On May 22, 1967, and before the beginning of a new mission in the Mediterranean Sea, the Liberty had slowly and steadily left the Norfolk port in the UK for the Guinea Gulf and the Abidjan port in the western shores of Africa. Its mission in this beautiful port in the country of the Ivory Coast was to listen in and find out whether things were going according to the US's liking or not.
We were sent around the world, wherever there might be a hot spot, to see if we could determine what was going on and if the United States desired any intervention of any sort.
The Liberty was leaving Abidjan port as Israeli forces were in military position and getting ready for action. Of course, the Egyptians were based in the Sinai Desert before them. The Israelis preferred for the issue to resolve without military action, because they weren't ready to fight and on two different fronts, from the southwest with Egypt and the north and east with Syria and Jordan.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
what
a situation
of law. What do you
want
the United States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
U.S. President Lyndon Johnson asked Israel not to start the war. This is exactly the same thing the USSR told its Arab ally, Egypt, to do. But Egypt had already taken the first step by closing the Straits of Tiran on Israeli ships. Things really got bad when other Arabs joined hands with Abdel Nasser and allied themselves with him in destroying Israel. King Hussein of Jordan was the first to sign a joint defensive alliance with Nasser and put his army under his orders. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia also went to meet with Nasser and pledged him his support. The U.S. wanted to know what secrets about the inevitable war in the Middle East the USSR was whispering in the ears of the Egyptians at any cost. These events were happening as the Liberty was in the Mediterranean and had reached the Rota naval station in Spain, so it could add three experts in Russian and Arabic to its crew. In the Israeli camp, the situation was in crisis mode. Egypt from the west, Jordan from the east, and Syria from the north are on standby, awaiting orders from Abdel Nasser to finish Israel off. Levi Eshkol, the Israeli Prime Minister, thought of a surprise attack as the only way to end the crisis and informed his new defense minister, Moshe Dayan, of his opinion. June 5, 1967, was chosen as the day to attack the Arabs. June 5th, 7 in the morning, 180 Israeli fighter jets flew towards Egypt. Only 12 fighter jets were left behind to defend the Israeli skies. Later, Egypt's military airport runways were bombed, and 280 Egyptian military jets on the ground were the targets of Israeli rockets. The Egyptians were so overwhelmingly surprised that they didn't even find the time to start their jet engines.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
With European populations starving and freezing this coming winter, it is not inconceivable that there might be a flood of European refugees fleeing across the English Channel and the Mediterranean to appear on the shores of West Asian countries. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the editor of Crescent International. This article is published under the heading, Europe Faces Dark and Cold Winter. Stay tuned for more. If labor discontent over rising food and fuel prices across Europe looks bad today, wait for the winter months. It could turn really ugly. Alarm bells are already ringing across Europe, with Germany leading the list of countries that could suffer the most, with declining industrial output as major industries teeter on the verge of collapse and shutoff of gas supplies to homes and cold showers for people. Riots cannot be ruled out in many European countries, with unpredictable consequences. Even the usually sedate New York Times carried the headline, Britain gears up for summer of labor discontent. Wait for the cold, damp winter months. Britain, dubbed the sick man of Europe, is faced with a leadership crisis that is the direct result of massive inflation that hit 9.1% in May. It has since rise in feather. The governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, admitted last month that the country is facing the biggest economic contraction in 300 years. Railway workers, including train drivers, school teachers, hospital staff, and even lawyers, are out in protest demanding higher wages. There is looming threat of a general strike across Britain. This is not surprising given that 20% of the population is short of basic foods and fuel. While Shell made a whopping £10 billion profit in the three-month period from April to June, ordinary people were hit with huge gas and fuel cost increases. When asked about the company's soaring profits amid punishingly high bills and a skyrocketing inflation faced by households, Shell's chief executive Ben Van Burden was dismissive. He said the company could not perform miracles. It could slash prices to provide some relief to the already suffering masses. That, however, would go against the holy grail of maximizing profits regardless of how much suffering it inflicts on the ordinary people. Other countries are also facing the threat of labor unrest, including Italy, France, Slovakia, and Finland. Again, the result of rising food and fuel prices. Some European countries, such as Hungary, Spain, Estonia, Greece, and Poland, have sought exemptions from European restrictions on gas imports from Russia and are working to strike their own separate deals. The situation has arisen as a direct result of US-led sanctions against Russia over its operation in Ukraine. High oil and gas prices have brought windfall profits to Russia, surpassing its earnings from those before the crisis in Eastern Europe. Moscow has also demanded payments in rubles, resulting in the Russian currency soaring to new heights against the US dollar. American weapons manufacturers love wars. They are salivating at the prospects of selling more weapons to Ukraine. More than $50 billion worth of weapons have been delivered to Kiev. On February 24, 2022, while Ukraine has no money to pay for them, America is pushing Kiev to continue fighting. Washington knows it can secure payment in the form of Ukrainian assets, minerals, and other commodities once the crisis ends. What Ukraine might look like after fighting stops is uncertain. The Russia sanctions have devastated the economies of most European countries. This is because they are dependent on Russian oil and gas. Germany, the leading industrial power in Europe, is most severely affected because it imports more than 40% of its gas from Russia. Both the IMF and Rabobank analysts paint a bleak picture of German economic outlook. Rabobank analysis predicts gas shortages will make a German recession inevitable. As a result of reduction in Russian gas flow, German cities have been forced to turn off lights on official buildings at night to save energy. Hannover became the first German city to shut off lights. Berlin, the capital city, Munich, and Lower Saxony followed suit. With longer summer days, this can be tolerable, but when winter approaches, the situation would become grim for the European countries. While the European Commission asked member states last month to make plans in the event of a complete gas cutoff from Russia, this is easier said than done. There is no alternative sources of oil and gas available for European countries immediately to make up the shortfall. Even in the medium term, this is not possible because of lack of infrastructure. With European populations starving and freezing this coming winter, it is not inconceivable that there might be a flood of European refugees fleeing across the English Channel and the Mediterranean to appear on the shores of the West Asian countries. If that were to happen, one thing is certain. European refugees will be treated far more humanely than the treatment Western regimes have meted out to refugees fleeing wars in West Asia and Africa. Welcome to the dawn of the New World Order.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
African nations and Africans in the diaspora are reviving their efforts to obtain reparations from colonial powers involved in the evil transatlantic slave trade and other colonial era atrocities. In pursuit of this objective, early August, a reparations and racial healing summit was held in Ghana. Addressing the summit, Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo pushed for reparations, but reiterated that no amount of money could restore the damage done by the slave trade.
You cannot quantify the effects of such tragedies, but they need to be recognized. Africa and her peoples lost out tremendously in that period, and its ripple effects are still being felt right to this very day.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today's edition is focusing on the recent summit on reparations and racial healing held in Accra, Ghana. The meeting discussed and reflected on the legacies of the transatlantic slave trade, slavery in America, colonialism, and strategies for reparations and racial healing. The second segment of our show today is on the latest developments regarding Britain's controversial plan to forcibly send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Our guests will be giving us their expert analysis on today's subjects, and you can also be part of the conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
Africa demands reparations for slavery. A global summit on reparations and racial healing was held in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, early August. The summit was co-hosted by the African Union Commission and the Africa Transitional Justice Legacy Fund. The main agenda of the meeting was to coordinate a comprehensive global strategy and agenda to secure reparations for the immoral and brutal transatlantic slave trade and European colonialism in Africa.
Speaking to Ghana's Joy TV, one of the participants elaborates on some of the salient points of the Accra Summit.
One, the importance of prioritizing reparations, not just as a process of remembering, but as the path forward to the kind of self-determining agency that we want for Africa and for people of African descent around the world. We have a collective strategy that is now in development that engages not just the grassroots, but also we have the African Union Commission has been involved on this question of how to develop a common position for Africa on the issue of reparations and healing. So a lot of this was about building relationships between inside the continent, but also between Africa and the diaspora, so that we can know each other, understand each other, develop collective strategy to challenge and change the systems and structures that, from the transatlantic slave trade through colonialism, neocolonialism, continue to exploit and harm.
Well, for more on the Accra Reparations Summit, we contacted Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
At the end of the Reparations Summit, a declaration known as the Accra Declaration was issued to push forward a global agenda for reparations and healing. Now, what is the importance of such a conference that took place in Accra?
Oh, it's extremely important. As you and your audience probably know, for a long time here in the United States, the descendants of enslaved Africans have been crusading, have been campaigning with regard to gaining reparations for the horrific depredations that were inflicted upon not only people of African descent in North America, but on the African continent as a whole. Indeed, Africa's underdevelopment today can be connected quite directly to the ravages of the African slave trade, which operated for centuries from about 1500 till about the late 19th century. And this meant that North America, the United States in particular, was built into its present superpower status by the free labor of enslaved Africans.
Speaking at the Reparations and Racial Healing Summit, Ghana's president said these reparations were long overdue and needed to be intensified. He questioned double standards in the reparations debate when it came to other races and ethnic groups that were wronged historically. Let's take a listen.
We believe the calls for reparations to Africa are just. The effects of the slave trade have been devastating to the continent and to the African diaspora. The entire period of slavery meant that our progress, economically, culturally, and psychologically, was stifled.
Now, I'd like to ask Mr. Horn, what's his take on the statement by the president of Ghana?
Well, he is absolutely correct. Recall that after what is referred to as the Holocaust, the killing of 6 million Jewish people in Central and Eastern Europe in the 1930s and the 1940s, you had the successor state in Berlin to Hitler's Germany pay reparations to Israel, even though Israel was not in existence at the time of the Holocaust. You still have reparations being paid to various peoples of Jewish descent, not only in Europe and in Israel, but in North America too. In the United States, you may recall that during World War II, 1941 to 1945, the United States, in turn, put in concentration camps Japanese Americans. About four decades later, the United States government apologized and paid reparations to those who had endured that horrible fate. And so I think the Ghanaian authorities were referring to these episodes when they made reference to hypocrisy and double standards, because it's apparent that hypocrisy and double standards persist.
The wealth of Western countries is built on slavery and colonialism. Yet, reparations have been routinely dismissed by Western leaders. For instance, the then British Prime Minister David Cameron, on a visit to Jamaica in 2015, rejected popular demands for compensation over slavery and colonialism. As expected, Cameron arrogantly stated that it was best for Jamaicans to move on.
No, I haven't been taken aback. Of course, this is an important debate. I mean, my view is that as we look into the past, we should think of all of the aspects of the past, not least the action that Britain took for many decades to wipe slavery off the high seas and off the face of our planet. And so I don't think reparations are the right answer. But the purpose of my visit is to look to the future.
There are concerns that the movement for reparations and apology will face major obstacles due to such stances by British officials.
Well, I think the London authorities need to rethink that inappropriate comment. One cannot understand or comprehend the British Empire, which once ruled a good deal of the world, including what is today's India, today's Pakistan, a good deal of Afghanistan and other neighbors of Iran. The British Empire was basically built upon labor of enslaved Africans. And so when the British authorities talk about it's time to move on, well, I think that that's not only insulting, it's obscene. They should be forced to apologize.
The president of Ghana also noted that even before these discussions on reparations conclude, the entire continent of Africa deserves a formal apology from the European nations involved in the slave trade for the crimes and damage it has caused to Africans. He lamented that Western countries are still practicing racism when it comes to reparations.
Predictably, the question of reparations becomes a debate only when it comes to Africa and Africans. When the British ended slavery, all the owners of enslaved slaves, Africans, received reparations to the tune of £20 million sterling, the equivalent today of £20 billion sterling. But enslaved Africans themselves did not receive a penny. Likewise, in the United States, owners of slaves received $300 for every slave they owned. The slaves themselves received nothing.
As Mr. Horn stated earlier, colonial powers involved in slavery must be forced to apologize. So why have these European powers so far refused to apologize and pay reparations for the crimes they committed?
Because they are enmeshed in a system that is not only immoral, but racist. And keep in mind, when we talk about the European nations that were involved in the slave trade, we're not only talking about Britain and France and Spain and Portugal. We're also talking about Denmark, for example. You may know that the U.S. territory known as the Virgin Islands was first controlled by Denmark before it was turned over about 100 years ago to the U.S. authorities. And of course, the Virgin Islands has an overwhelmingly black population because of the slave trade. The Swedes were involved in the slave trade. So this is a crime against humanity perpetrated by leading nations of Western Europe who purport to be paragons of human rights virtue, but actually are no more than pirates and thieves and immoral knaves.
The church, and especially the Roman Catholic Church as an institution, was instrumental in facilitating the transatlantic slave trade.
The church played a direct role and was complicit in the sins of anti-black racism, slavery, and segregation in the modern era. An African-American historian gives a glimpse of how the church was involved in enslaving Africans.
Catholics had used slaves and the slave economy to evade anti-Catholic laws and survive anti-Catholic violence. They embraced human bondage to secure their own liberty. The pro-slavery and anti-abolitionist tradition in the Catholic hierarchy began not with the arrival of the Irish in the 19th century, but with the emergence of the Catholic Church as a legal institutional church at the end of the American Revolution.
Now, what role should the church play in pushing for reparations?
The Vatican should be in the forefront of the campaign for reparations. Not only because the Roman Catholic Church was deeply implicated in the African slave trade. Indeed, you may be familiar with Georgetown University, a university that sits in Washington, D.C., and was initiated by the Roman Catholic Church. You may also know that about 200 years ago, when Georgetown University fell upon hard times, it sold scores of enslaved Africans in order to fatten its bottom line. And that's one of the reasons why you've had delegations of Black Americans traveling to the Vatican, engaging in discussions and consultations with the Vatican authorities about their role in the African slave trade, because the Vatican is supposedly a moral authority. That's one of the reasons why you had the Pope recently visit Canada, apologizing for what the Catholics did to the indigenous population of Canada.
It is a very emotional topic indeed for Africans, and we look forward to the day when the perpetrators of slavery apologize for their crimes and pay reparations. Here at Press TV, we shall keep you posted as Africans in Africa and the diaspora pursue reparations and healing. I would like to thank Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston, for his insight. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the controversial plan by Britain to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Stay tuned.
Britain ignores warnings over Rwanda asylum plan. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Reports have revealed that the British government was warned not to send asylum seekers to Rwanda as the government in this Central African country tortures and kills political opponents. The warning came several weeks before the British government attempted to forcibly send asylum seekers to Rwanda.
The controversial plan was temporarily halted after the European Court of Human Rights issued injunctions to force the cancellation of the first deportation flight hours before it was due to leave for Rwanda in June. London's High Court is also expected to hear the case in early September, when a coalition of human rights groups and a trade union will argue that the Rwanda policy is unworkable and unethical.
Britain's plan has attracted international condemnation. The spokesperson for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees says it is a violation of international law to send asylum seekers to Rwanda against their will.
Asylum seekers, people seeking asylum and safety. And we just want to reiterate that access to asylum should not be and is not contingent on the mode of arrival, how people arrive.
Now, for more on Britain's plan to forcibly send refugees to Rwanda, we contacted Claude Gachebuke, the co-author of the book Survivors Uncensored. He's also a survivor of the Rwanda genocide and currently the executive director of the Africa Great Lakes Action Network. Thanks a lot for your time today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the British government was reportedly warned several times by its own advisors that it's not prudent to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. So why did London ignore this advice?
I think London ignored the voice and the advice because at the end of the day, their attitude was they do not care about the well-being of the asylum seekers, and the refugees who were seeking refuge in Britain. They were only looking to score political points. And at the time, there was such turmoil in the British government that it was just a nice cover-up to use the refugee issue and the immigrant issue, which is usually the default, to kind of hide behind and distract from the political issues.
Britain claims to champion for human rights, yet it has ignored human rights experts who have objected to plans to transfer asylum seekers to Rwanda. There is concern that many of the asylum seekers will endure suffering in Rwanda. A protester speaks here during a march against the controversial plan in London.
They are not looking at what exactly is in that country. They are looking at the fact that Britain is getting an opportunity to dispose of asylum seekers. But they are not seeing the life they are putting in danger.
What does it say of the double standards pursued by Britain and other Western countries when it comes to human rights?
I was actually one of the most vocal voices when it comes to this issue of transferring immigrants to Rwanda. I called it human trafficking. I called it slavery. I called it basically bundling people up and shipping them from Britain to Rwanda. What it says about Britain and Western West's attitude toward human rights is that the only human rights they care about are the human rights of people, Western people. It's well known that Rwanda has a horrible record on human rights, yet it still receives hundreds of thousands of dollars from the British, from the Americans, and from the European Union. And if these refugees were coming from countries that are Western countries, where most of the refugees were white, I very strongly believe that they would not be shipped to Rwanda.
The UK-Rwanda asylum plan has come under fire as rising numbers of refugees are crossing the channel in small boats to seek refuge in the UK. In July, 3,683 people crossed from France. The total number of this year is believed to be more than 17,000. Britain claims its policy of forcibly sending asylum seekers to Rwanda will help end the people smugglers' trade. But now many analysts disagree with this claim.
I absolutely disagree, because actually what Britain is doing by basically trading these humans with Rwanda, it's human trafficking in itself. The only difference is that this time it's legalized. It's government to government that are trafficking humans. You cannot take a person from a place that they desire to be and take them to a place that they do not desire to be.
Despite Iran's economic difficulties and unjust sanctions, the country generously hosts millions of asylum seekers from various countries, particularly Afghanistan. When he was the UNCHR chief, Antonio Guterres, the current UN Secretary General, visited Iran in 2014. During the visit, he paid glowing tribute to the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Iranian people for continuing to preserve asylum space for the refugees.
It is only fair to pay tribute to the generosity of the people and the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran that for decades have received, have protected, and have assisted, at the moment, almost 3 million refugees, still today almost 1 million refugees, sharing everything with them and providing them the access to shelter, to work, to education for their children, to health services, and allowing them to have a dignifying life while waiting for the possibility to go back home.
While Iran is hosting millions of refugees and granting them full rights, on the other hand, the self-proclaimed flag bearers of human rights, such as Britain, cannot tolerate the presence of thousands of refugees. What's your take on this?
That is such an irony that you point out. It just goes to show that when it comes to human rights, Western hypocrisy comes out flying. And for example, if you would look at the criticism that Iran gets and the praise that Rwanda gets and compare the human rights abuses in both places, it's crazy to see that such a champion of human rights would actually criticize one and go after the other. Now, with Britain not being able to tolerate even thousands of people who are in distress, that just goes to show that many times their claim to human rights is just completely lip service.
The Rwanda scheme presents a sad reminder of Britain's imperial past, the colonial transportation of slaves and workers across continents and seas. Imposing the asylum plan in a poor country such as Rwanda is financially beneficial to the UK and is seen as part of Britain's post-Brexit strategy. So, can we say that the Rwanda asylum plan is a clear reflection of Britain's imperial past?
Absolutely. I've been saying this since the very first day this deal was announced. I'd say that this is not only human trafficking, this is no different than the transatlantic slave trade, where humans were being traded for money. And so this legalized human trafficking between the UK and Rwanda basically takes humans against their will, takes them to a place they do not desire to be, and there is an exchange of money. There is a price for actually doing that service. So people are being treated like commodities. They're being treated like goods. And that's basically what was happening even with the transatlantic slave trade. And so today, this is just a complete reflection of Britain's colonial past, slave trading past, but also the neo-colonialist attitude and imperialist attitude.
Well, there you have it. Britain's controversial plan to forcibly transfer asylum seekers to Rwanda is a continuation of its evil legacy of slave trade and imperialism. Thank you very much, Mr. Claude Bitabuke, for your incisive analysis today. And that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en.